Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. What's better than eating oysters with champagne for New Year's? Well, hearing a Frenchman talk about his love of the oyster. Plus, the Mexican beer cocktail that's coming into the mainstream. What the difference is between juiced up punch and a cocktail. And some faux pas to avoid when you're at a holiday party. But first, let's see what's in season this week at the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're looking forward to one more fun holiday in the new year, and we're still looking for exciting things to cook and ways to dazzle and entertain our friends and family. Luckily, we have Mary Sue Milliken here at the market. She's, of course, one half of the two hot tamales that own the Border Grill in Ciudad. And Mary Sue shops here all the time. She's an ardent organic purchaser. So Mary Sue, you're here. You're excited. It's the new year. What are you going to cook?
Whenever I'm getting ready to celebrate New Year's, I have to have fresh oysters. And these new oysters that are coming up out of Carlsbad are delicious.
Right. And they've got two or three different kinds.
Yeah, and they're sustainable, and they're local, and they're right here. I bought them before my son left for college. I said, what do you want before you go? You know, last meal, he said, oysters.
Such a sophisticated son.
So I said, well, I'll go to the farmer's market. I found him. He's also got clams and delicious mussels. So I think, you know, New Year's is a nice time to have. I make a clam dip with those fresh clams. I open them up and I fry them in a tiny bit of butter and I add them to sour cream and kind of caramelized onions. Mm. The oysters, I just open them up and I make the simplest vinaigrette where I take shallots, and Peter Shaner over here has gorgeous shallots today, and I just chop them up, put them in the blender with some delicious red wine vinegar, and I blend it into like a puree, a thin puree, and I just put a tiny dab of it on each oyster, and they're fantastic.
You're right, and now you know how to shuck the oysters.
Not hard at all. You know, I actually cover my hand with a towel, a damp towel, and then I have another towel on the countertop, so the oysters between the two towels. Because if I do slip, then it'll hit the towel and not my hand necessarily. Right. But there's a little place, and the gentleman who sells the oysters, Robert, he'll show you if you're not used to it. Of course, I've been in the restaurant business so long that and New Year's is always a big time for oysters for me. And of course, both restaurants are serving oysters this year, as every year. But you do get good. There's a little spot right there at the back, the hinge, and if you just pop it, then you're in.
Then you got to cut it off the shell.
Then you cut it off the shell.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, best not to cut it off the bottom part of the shell. I just learned this recently. Oh. I think it makes it taste better longer. Each diner should cut it off the bottom shell themselves.
And you leave that little bit of nice seawater, that nice salty, clean water on there.
I do.
You don't have to dump them out.
Like to rinse them or anything like that, because there's so much delicious liquor. They call it the oyster liquor. But I do take, if they're very dirty, I try to scrub them first with a stiff brush to get all the sand out. But if they're dirty, I do take my thumb or a little, even a pastry brush dipped in water or salted water, and I just whisk out the edges, because that's usually, if there's a little bit of dirt, it's right along the edge, and you want to just make sure you don't have that, because you don't want to feed dirt to your
esteemed guests. Now, Robert tells me that they've got a process down there at Carlsbad Aqua Farm where they actually put those in a recirculating clean bath of fresh seawater for 48 hours after they're harvested. And these oysters are not sitting on the bottom. They're suspended, so they're never lying in sand.
Yeah.
So I think they're super clean.
My experience with his oysters are that they're very clean and really tasty and so fresh and delicious.
So what is a good serving per person if you're going to be serving a lot of them?
If you have oyster lovers and you're going to serve, for New Year's Eve, I always like to have tons of little things to eat, like the clam dip, the oysters, maybe, you know, all kinds of little things. I do steak tartare and dips, and then I have a big pot of soup at the end because, you know, you need something for your tummy to coat all that.
Oh, that sounds so good.
But I would say six, if you have oyster lovers, six per person is good. And if they're maniacs, a dozen.
Okay, so a few extras. All right. Okay, now what are we going to wash all this down with? Got something to quaff?
Oh, I do, actually. Yeah. Well, I love blood orange juice, so we make a blood orange margarita, which is great because they're a little less strong. You know, now in my 50s, I can't drink too many margaritas, and I make mine with more orange juice. So mm-hmm. it adds a little sweetness. Instead of just straight lime, I always put a little bit of half blood orange, half lime juice, then a fine tequila and a little triple sec.
So you don't need to add sugar?
Mm-hmm. I don't add them to my personal margaritas. Mm-hmm. You can, but the triple sec has some sweetness, and blood orange juice has some sweetness.
Fabulous.
It's going to be a good year for food.
Good.
I'm sure about that. Maybe not for money, but I think 2009 is going to be a great year for food. I can just feel it.
Good. That's so great. Well, Mary Sue, it's always great to see you here. Get these great recipes.
Thank you, Laura.
That was, of course, Mary Sue Milliken. She's one half of the Two Hot Tamales, who are the Border Grill Ciudad pair, and always great to get an inspirational recipe. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Do you have a friend who can call and you can ask for restaurant advice? Well, I do. His name is Jonathan Gold, and he just happens to be the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for the LA Weekly. And lucky for us, he's here next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I don't know about you, but I certainly look forward to Saturdays when I know that Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Jonathan Gold will be joining us. And so today is one of those days. Jonathan's here with me, and I don't know, let me guess, are we going to a Chinese restaurant?
You saw the Alhambra address on my notes. There's a lot of cool new things happening in the San Gabriel Valley, and this is a cool new thing that's almost an old thing. There's a restaurant called King Hua, which is in the way west of Alhambra, and it's been a million restaurants over the years. C-Star was one of them. There were a couple others. And they hired away, rumor has it, the dim sum kitchen from the very well-regarded Sea Harbor restaurant.
So given that they made this decision, what is this group of dim sum makers known for?
Dim sum? Really? But sort of an elegant style, very Hong Kongish and very influenced by Vancouver, where the original Sea Harbor was. There are things like fried chicken knees, for example.
Chickens have knees?
Apparently they do. It's like you're cutting up a chicken. You've got the part that's the delicious thigh, and you've got the leg, and you've got that sort of bony thing in the middle. And you toss it with salt and pepper and probably a little cornstarch, and you fry it with a lot of garlic.
I would love that, because that's just cartilage, right?
It's just pure, chewy, garlicky cartilage.
I would love that.
Some of the interesting things this place has that aren't universally available, although they have very good versions of your basic shumai and hargao.
Which are the little dumplings that are filled with shrimp and pork.
Yeah. Actually, really nice hargao. They're flavored sort of subtly with white pepper, so there's like just another dimension going on rather than the usual frozen shrimp chunked into a rice wrapper. And they're good at the rice wrappers. They're very gooey. They do another rice noodle dish wrapped around shreds of chicken and bitter melon, which is cooked al dente, which is not a way you usually get it. It looks like big celery. It's really good. It's a really refreshing summer dish. And after you've had all the heavy dim sum stuff, to have the sort of bracingly bitter vegetable is nice. It's a real palate cleanser.
It seems like it would be a good digestive, too, after having consumed too much.
It could be. They sometimes carry dishes around, and sometimes you'll get things that you had never contemplated getting. There was something that showed up last week, which was this beautiful braise of like pickles, like pickled cabbage with mushrooms, and I could not figure out what it was. It was these tubes. They sort of looked like bungee tubes, but they were like flowers at the end from some creature that I could not tell from just a bite, and it was interesting.
When you say that, that's daunting.
One of the things that I thought was funny was the squid stuff with foie gras. Foie gras has always been sort of a thing at Sea Harbor. And these are little, like, football-shaped fried things made out of pounded squid paste. And in the middle, they are stuffed with foie gras, but it is a piece of foie gras that is half the size of a baby's fingernail. I mean, it's something you need a microscope to see. I would say it's the size of a pea, but you could probably fit four or five of them into a pea.
So that might be something to avoid.
It's a really good squid thing, as long as you're not expecting much in the way of foie gras.
So I notice they also have congee, which is one of my favorite things.
They have really good congee. My favorite one is the one with dried scallops and pork meatballs.
Congee, of course, being the rice porridge that's often eaten for breakfast.
Right, with a really nice full broth. They have a dim sum specialty of congee made of exotic things. So the last time I was there, I ordered a lobster congee thinking it sounded good. And the head waiter came over and whispered in my ear, "You know, this is going to cost $65. I did not know it was going to cost $65, so I got the one with fish balls instead, and I was happy as a clam.
What is the best time to go? I mean, on weekends, it's major slammo, right?
Yeah, it's always slammo weekends. And since you get your stuff to order, it's always hot and fresh, so there's no problem about going at 2.
Are they open for dim sum during the week?
They are open for dim sum during the week. And, of course, they have – it's a, you know, terrifically elegant seafood banquet restaurant at night.
So tell us the name of the restaurant once again and where it's located.
The name of this restaurant is King Wa, and it is a 2000 West Main Street in Alhambra.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Get more Jonathan Gold at kcrw.com/goodfood. He's with me on the show nearly every week now and always has new places worth trying. What's the difference between a cocktail and punch? Turns out it depends on whether it's served in a bowl or a glass. Campanile chef Mark Peel tries to explain while getting me drunk. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. A couple of weeks ago, I had one of those nights at Angeli. I was really beat by the time I was ready to leave the restaurant, so I thought, Campanile's just down the street from my house. I think I'll go have a drink at that wonderful bar. So I go sit in the bar with a girlfriend of mine, and who's there but Mark Peel, the chef owner of Campanile. What followed was this amazing cocktail experience born out of his desire to share everything he had learned at this cocktail conference he had attended in New Orleans. So here you are.
I've returned a month or so ago from the Tale of the Cocktail, which is in July in New Orleans.
You just have to tell the story of the one gin seminar you had. What time did it take place?
Oh, it started at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was called Ginapalooza. We walk in and set up in front of every chair is 16 different gins laid out. And then they bring out four or five cocktails.
And I immediately, of course, asked you, was there a spit bucket?
And they offered spit buckets. They said, would anybody like a spit bucket? Please raise your hand. The silence was deafening. No, we're good. We're fine. Over here. Yeah, we're good.
So after I had this great conversation with you, you've done even more cocktail research. So what is the first thing we're going to drink?
The first thing we're going to try is a very, very old cocktail. It's not actually a cocktail because a cocktail is a specific type of a drink. It's a mixed drink like a martini or a sidecar or a cosmopolitan. This is a punch, and punch is a very old type of a drink, but the word punch derives from a Hindu word meaning five, and the ingredients in a punch are always five. In this one, it is peaches, sugar, peach brandy, regular brandy, and rum.
And we should say that making these drinks for us is Campanile bartender Maria Ochoa. How old is this recipe, and how old are punches?
Punches go back to at least the early 18th century. And this one is from, you're going to have to pronounce the name of that river again because
the Schuylkill.
The Schuylkill Hunt and Fish Club, which was founded in 1732 on the banks of that river.
Oh, my goodness. This is marvelous.
It's a hunting and fishing club where men would go out, spend time in the woods with their buddies, go hunting and fishing, grow their beards, scratch places, and they would drink this punch.
They would drink this pink punch.
This punch recipe is probably 250 years old.
Amazing. Now, did cocktails come from wanting to have an individual serving of punch?
Yes. Some people would say when society started to break down, because punch you would make in vast bowls, and no one would leave until the punch bowl was empty. Cocktails were for individuals, when a person, one person would go in and have a drink. So then we're going to move on to cocktails. And one is going to be a variation on a martini, and the other one is going to be a variation on the margarita.
Okay, now one of the things I loved the night that you got me drunk at Campanile was when you told me the names of these drinks.
Oh.
So first let's do the martini variant. And what is this one called?
Okay, this is the Lord Nelson. A martini is gin. A vodka martini is not really a martini. This is going to be Plymouth gin, which is the traditional gin of the British Navy, mixed with a white Lillet, the red Lillet, which is like a vermouth. The glasses gets flamed with an orange zest. It has a little bit of orange bitters in it with a touch of sugar. And the French and the British have hated each other for centuries. And so I named it the Lord Nelson because the flaming orange represents the Battle of Trafalgar when Lord Nelson defeated the French Navy.
Now, what are some tricks? I see here that in our martini glasses, there's some ice in there. Now, what is the ice doing in there?
Because martini glasses should start out cold.
Because a lot of what happens in a cocktail is how much the ice that is in the shaker melts.
Yes, and hence, I love this one, shaken, not stirred. It's actually the other way around. A martini should be stirred, not shaken, in my opinion.
Why?
Because it gets too diluted. Part of the beauty of a great cocktail is its transparency, its beautiful transparency. And you'll see this one, it's a beautiful, kind of an amber-orange color. And if you shake it, it's going to become translucent, kind of milky looking. You know what's interesting is how many cocktails are so similar. And it's all about balance as well. Sweet, salt, sugar, and bitter. Bitterness is an important part of a cocktail. Mm. It gives a freshness. Like the difference between a margarita, a sidecar, and a cosmopolitan is only in the spirit. A sidecar is brandy, a margarita is tequila, and a Cosmo is citrus-flavored vodka and has a touch of cranberry juice for a color. That's it. Otherwise, they're the same.
Okay, now this next one, I love the name of this, the Pancho Victoria.
The variation on the margarita. I call it the Pancho Victoria because Pancho Villa just evokes tequila.
Yeah, of course.
The Victoria part of it is because this has just a float, half a teaspoon of a nice, smoky, peaty scotch right on top.
You're making a margarita. Now, are you making it traditionally?
No, because it does not have the triple sec or the Cointreau. Instead, we're using a combination of lime juice, but also Oro Blanco grapefruit. Well, that type of grapefruit is not overly sweet. It has a sharpness, like I said, a touch of bitterness and a clarity to the flavor, which is great. But then also we made a sugar syrup with Thai lime leaves, fresh ginger, and lemon zest boiled into a simple syrup.
Tell me the story about scotch. You tell me a great story.
Oh, yes, of course. Why it's Victoria? Because it's Queen Victoria. Because in the 19th century, the scotch trade was kind of on the skids. It wasn't very popular. It was French brandies were taking over. But Queen Victoria started drinking scotch, and she loved scotch. And then, just like today, whatever the royal family does becomes fashionable. And so she single-handedly saved the scotch industry from demise.
Okay. So this is the Pancho Victoria.
Pancho Victoria.
Wow. It's like drinking a barbecued margarita.
Mm.
This has been one of the most fun segments that I can remember.
Thank you.
Campanile is where you'll find chef and owner Mark Peel. Some pictures of the drinks and the brands of liquor used are at kcrw.com/goodfood. I do love beer. That's a fact that frequent listeners to this show already know. But I'm about to experience beer in a slightly different way, on ice with hot sauce. The Mexicans call it, and others like it, a michelada. I've invited Jimmy Shaw, owner of Loteria Grill in the Farmers Market and his brand new full-service restaurant of the same name in Hollywood, to come and give some lessons in Mexican cocktailing. He's brought along Carlos, his bartender, and a full bar's worth of beer and tequila. Woohoo!
So what we're going to do is we're going to play with a couple different kinds of micheladas. And michelada really comes from, it's mi cerveza helada, is the...
Mi cerveza helada, yeah. It's not me chilando. I always think it's like I'm chilling.
Well, it's kind of, you know, it comes from that because it's, bueno, chelear is to go to have some beers, right?
It is?
Yeah, because a chelita is a nice little cold beer. I think the original michelada, which is mi cerveza helada, right, mm-hmm. came from, well, Mexico's such a huge beer culture. So it came from somebody probably wanting a beer colder than was available. So it was put on ice. And then, you know, the Mexican palate has such great profile of sweet and savory and sour and chile and all these things come
and
together.
Salty.
And salty. So I think we get all the food groups into one with a michelada.
Okay, we're dipping. We're now, Carlos is dipping into lime juice, the edge of the glass, then into salt.
Mm. And so we're going to start with what would be the michelada clásica. And in this case, it would be done with a little bit of Liam Perrin's Worcester sauce, with Maggi, which is basically a concentrated soy salt, if you will.
What Maggi is like the little cube?
Maggi juice.
Maggi juice. Now, is this like laden with MSG?
No, actually it doesn't have MSG, but it's a ton of salt.
So it must be like a yeasty thing, sort of like
Marmite.
Vegemite
and Marmite made into a juice. So what we're doing now is we're gonna squeeze Ooh. In some real fresh lime juice straight out of the limes. And you can get, you know, now you can get the key limes in good quantities. You used to have to struggle for them. Now we can get them very easily.
Okay, why would you use a key lime versus a traditional lime?
The flavor is it's much more pungent than the regular lime. It's a little more tart.
Okay, let's watch what Carlos is doing. So he's added the fresh lime. He added the Liam Perrins. Now he's adding
tapatio sauce.
And not Tabasco, tapatio sauce.
I would go with a more Mexican salsa, which would either be tapatio or something like Valentina.
So now let's talk about the carrier, the beer itself. Now you're using Sol. Do you want to have something really light?
In the case of the micheladas we're doing right now, yes, because you want it to be very refreshing. Sol would be a fabulous beer for that. Things like Dos Equis Lager would work too. If you wanted a little heavier, then you go with the Bohemias, or, as I showed you the other day, these great Mexican microbrews that are coming out. Cucapa from Tijuana is putting out some magnificent beers. So this would be the michelada tradicional, the real traditional michelada.
Oh, my gosh.
Let's
Can
go to
I have
boat,
this
right?
to go? I feel like I'm in Evan's Good Food Speakeasy.
And imagine that on a beach with a little bit of shrimp.
Wow, that's delicious.
So that one, it's very simple. It's beer, a dash of Worcester sauce, a dash of Maggi, and a hot sauce. In the event that you don't have the Maggi sauce, soy sauce works. You just want something
that's umami. With it. It's like that big hit of bottom flavor.
Exactly. Mm. And you want the saltiness of it.
What is the next one that Carlos is doing?
Okay, so we've played with a couple different versions of it. This is the enchilada, or the picosa.
The enchilada?
The michelada enchilada. So it's slightly, it's more on the chile and less on the salt.
Okay. Wow, that's really delicious. Is it canned pepper that I'm seeing floating around?
Well, no, you're seeing pepper sauce. So again, in this case, it would be tapatio.
Mm.
But you could do this. This would be great with an habanero sauce.
Oh, this is delicious. So the difference in this one?
Is less of the salt. It doesn't have the Maggi or the Worcester sauce.
Now, do you have a tomato-based one?
Today, we don't have a tomato-based one, but I actually do have a surprise for you on tomato, which we're going to do in a little bit.
Okay.
But right now, we're going to now go to the fruitier micheladas, and we've got two that we make at Loteria, which one has mango in it, and it's fresh mango juice.
Is it mixed with the beer?
Yes.
That's genius.
And then there's another one that we do with a little bit of orange. So it's playing with the different beer flavors.
So it's like a beer agua.
Yeah.
A bagua.
A bagua. A chelagua. We're going to put a little fresh mango juice in right now.
Now, your mango juice, do they come from fresh mangoes?
Yes.
Wow, you juice the fresh mangoes.
The fresh mangoes.
Oh, and what kind? Do you use the little Indian ones?
I really love the mango manila. That to me is the mango that I grew up with, and it means...
Describe what it looks like.
It's a yellow mango, probably around 6 inches, and they usually start popping in at the end of April, beginning of May, and they'll go through the end of July or so.
Wow. And it's so beautiful. I mean, this is really festive and pretty. You've got, you know, the deep color in the glass, and then you've got that beautiful pepper, chili pepper rim. I'm assuming that's what that is.
That's exactly what it is. It's a combination of chiles with a little bit of lime and salt. Try that.
That's just genius. I mean, I would so much rather drink this than a punch. The thing that's really great about this drink, too, is it's not highly alcoholic.
Right. It's meant to be refreshing, and it extends your beer.
Jimmy, so tell me what the last cocktail we're going to have is.
This is a cocktail that we've just created at Loteria, and we call it the Oaxacan Sunrise. And we wanted to play with mezcal, because mezcal is coming up in the world, and it's such a delicious spirit. And so what we did here is we mixed a little bit of tomato juice, orange juice, and lime, and we mixed it with the mezcal, and we're going to put a hint of chile in at the end.
Now, the chile that you use, is fresh, or you're using the tapatio?
No, in this case, we're using tapatio.
Great.
We do have a fresh chile that we use in our jalapeño margarita, and there we actually juice the jalapeño.
That's really good. It's odd, because you're not used to that green flavor in a margarita, but it's really good.
And so we're going to serve up the Oaxacan Sunrise.
Wow, there's so much stuff going on in there. It's completely unlike anything I've ever had.
We tried a million versions to get to it, which is why it took us probably a couple weeks of naps to understand how to make it finally.
The smokiness in it is just fantastic. And to have that smoky flavor with something that has a little orange is very strange but quite wonderful.
The tomatoes what balances it out.
Meet Carlos in person at the new Loteria Grill restaurant on Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood. Oh, and apparently they have food too. Jimmy Shaw owns both the Loteria Grill restaurant and the stand in the original Farmer's Market, and it's a pleasure having him come by good food. There's one other thing we do besides eat at the holidays. We also gather. And when we gather, we sometimes get stuck having to talk to people who are, well, frankly, boring. So what to do? Advice from the etiquette expert next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Some find parties fun. Others know that being stuck with people you don't know can just be a big drag. So what can you do? Today I'm turning to Chow.com's etiquette columnist, Helena Eichlin, for some advice. Helena, this time of year, when we're going to all types of parties, New Year's parties in particular, there seem to be a lot of dips around. And that activity, which is often called double dipping, of dipping your chip in something, taking a bite, and then going back to dip it in again, is often viewed with total horror. Should we be horrified, or are people making too big a deal out of it?
Well, I found out that somebody has actually bothered to do some scientific research into this question. She's a professor of microbiology, and I interviewed her a couple of days ago and asked her about the study. And basically what she did is she had got five dips from the supermarket, and then she had her students double dip in the dips, and then she left them to sit at room temperature for an hour, and then she took a sample from each dip and measured it, and she found they had negligible levels of bacteria in them, i.e. double dipping isn't really as heinous and unsanitary as we all think.
Yeah, because I remember as a child, everybody double dipped and nobody said anything, and then all of a sudden it just sort of crept into our culture. How socially offensive do you think it really is?
Well, it may be a personal thing, and it may be because I actually prefer that people not do it. Because it's like, I think it's like spitting on someone when you talk to them, like a little fleck of saliva lands on you when you're talking to someone, and it's not unpleasant, and you're very unlikely to catch anything from it, but I would rather it didn't happen, and it's easy to avoid. But I don't think it's the guest's responsibility to avoid double dipping, because when you're standing around dips at a party, you're drinking, you're talking, you're not really thinking about, you know, chip etiquette. So I think the host is the one who should prevent double dipping. And it's easy to do that just by making all your crudités bite-sized, cutting them up small, and then just getting the bite-sized tortilla chips.
Now I'm very interested in this idea of someone spitting on your face, which might happen during New Year's. You know, everybody's
yes.
imbibing. You have a drink in one hand. You have your dip and your chip in the other. What if somebody does have that spit land on our face? What do we do?
I think this is a dilemma, because if you do wipe it off, the person will probably notice, and then they might be embarrassed that they've done that. But then they'll say, I'm sorry for spitting on you, and you'll say it's not a problem. But
I think the proper thing to do is for the spitter to go ahead and wipe it off of the spittee.
At a New Year's Eve party, that could be a form of flirting and could lead to...
That's true. It could lead to something that you don't really want. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about mingling. Is it the host's responsibility to sort of bring shy people out into the party?
I think you have to make some effort. And the way to do that is you just introduce them to someone and then say, Bob, Betty is a skilled accordion player. And... And then tell Betty something about Bob, and then they have something to start off with. And you could make a couple of introductions, but then after that, the shy person can't sustain a conversation. I mean, you have other duties as a host to worry about.
But I like that idea. I like the idea of not just introducing people with a name, but like a one-liner that is sort of, it piques one's interest. So it would be easy for the shy person to follow up with a question.
Yes.
What if... people are not leaving. How do you get them out of your house?
You can just say, everybody, I'm going to have to throw you out. It's been great, but I'm really exhausted and I need to go to bed. But I think that also kind of ends things on a slightly sour note. So if possible, you want to give them subtle hints and make them think that it was their idea to go. And so I've devised a three-step strategy, maybe it's four steps, to help people get rid of guests who stay too long. And the first stage is environmental cues. So you dim, you turn the lights up, you turn the music off, you turn out the candles and that sort of thing. And then the next stage is verbal hints. And here you use a technique that I call the before you go technique. And so you use the phrase before you go. And then after that, you ask them a flattering question with a short answer. So here's an example. Before you go, you must tell me where you got those wonderful boots. And then they answer the question, but you've implanted the going idea in their head, but they aren't really offended by it because they're sort of feeling flattered by the fact that you love their boots. And it actually works. I've tried this out several times.
And what if that doesn't work, which is stage two? When do you bring out the big guns?
Sometimes people are drunk and they just don't get those kinds of hints. So the final stage, if you're really desperate, of course, is pajamas. But you want to be careful here. It's not the time to break out, you know, a filmy negligee.
That might send a whole entirely different message.
That strategy could backfire because I've done this, changed into my pajamas several times, but I don't actually sleep in pajamas. I sleep in like sweatpants and like a T-shirt. And so when I come into the room in this outfit, I think a lot of the time people think, oh, Helen has just changed out of her dress because she wants to be really comfortable and settle in for a long chat.
Oh, gosh. Time to get a pair of those Nick and Noras with the funny dogs on them.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You keep them specially for such occasions.
Absolutely. Thank you, Helena.
Thank you.
You can find Helena Eichlin at Chow Magazine. I've got links to her columns on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. There are many different types of oysters with all their own flavor. For wine, we say that the flavor of the grapes are influenced by the terroir, or the elements that come from where the grapes actually grow. My next guest will show us that an oyster's flavor depends on the sea from which it came. It's Miroir. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW
and KCRW.com. Oysters. You either love them or you're too chicken to try them. We have here in town a really incredible oyster specialist who's had a lifelong love affair with the oyster. I realized reading an article that he wrote that even though they're creatures of the sea, oysters might just be the purest example of taste that relies on terroir that we have. So I'm so happy to introduce Christophe Hapillon. So tell me, what caused you to fall in love with the oyster?
Well, I came by the way of the ocean, growing around a small city in the south of France, and doing scuba diving, popping oyster and eating oyster. That was the first encounter. Then also the Christmas time with parents around, men in the kitchen opening oyster as a little kid, trained to get involved with them, bragging that you can handle one of them, looking at the knife in their hands. You know, it's like it's a rite and passage of manhood, I will say, in a lot of culture, especially France, but as well in Ireland, Italy, Spain.
And you had the opportunity to open a lovely French restaurant here in town, Anisette.
Yes.
And what was your position there?
I was a master écaillé, maître écaillé, so in charge of the shellfish department. That's how I basically came into the oyster and came back to the oyster in Los Angeles.
Let's talk a little bit about why this particular season you feel is such a perfect time for eating oysters here. There's something about the way the oyster starts to prepare for its season.
Yes. When the summer is over, they get a little bit skinny. So they're going to start to feed out of this plankton that's basically is plentiful in this season, starting in September. We've got the first rain in the northern part of America, especially Washington, British Columbia, or eastern region like Massachusetts. And those rain going to basically wash out the alluvium, the silt from the land, and bring that into the water. This nitrogen input going to be the fertilizer for the phytoplankton, which is phyto-based from the plant. And it is a tremendous bloom of planktonic organism that's going to feed those oysters. Those oysters, which are filter animals, basically take the plankton off the water. An oyster can filter 50 gallons of water a day, one oyster.
That's quite amazing. That's pretty amazing.
Basically, we get a sweet taste of the oyster from this phytoplankton.
And that's also, I mean, what fascinates me is this, the silt that passes down into the ocean creates a particular phytoplankton bloom depending upon where you are in the country. So the oysters are ingesting something that's extremely purely local.
That's the main reason why we're talking about terroir from the oyster. Terroir, it's a sense of the land. In France, there is even more, there is a miroir, the sense of the sea, sea being mer. So each oyster gonna test a special taste of the water where they grow up. We call that miroir.
So I love that there's a word for that. We have to create one in English. And so this is the primary reason that oysters would taste differently, those that are grown like off the coast here in Carlsbad versus San Francisco, the Pacific Northwest, and the East.
Absolutely. The oyster from the West Coast, especially Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, we've got the Rocky Mountain. It's a huge range of what we call new mountain. They are fairly new, and contrary as Appalachian, which are old. So those mountains still produce a lot of silt. They're still in motion. There's a lot of earthquake in the west coast. So it's a very plastic coast. So each time we've got the rain, we've got a lot of dirt that gets into the water. It's going to feed a huge bloom from the phytoplankton. The test will be a little bit of a seaweed, earthy test from the western oyster.
Christoph, talk to me a little bit more about this rite of passage that you referred to at the beginning of our conversation. Is there a particular ritual for a young French boy who's growing into manhood regarding the oyster?
Opening oyster, it's a male tradition. And you get to really push with your elbow to be allowed first to eat an oyster.
First even to eat one?
Yes, because it's such a big morsel. It's not really appealing, you know. It's like the first man that hit an oyster was a bald man. I don't know which author said that. It's not from me. It's a quotation. So,
and does it happen that a boy would take his first bite of oyster and just be horrified and want to spit it out?
I think that's what you will do as a boy. That's not what you should do if you want to be a man.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Christoph Hapillon is an oyster expert. Find more information about his gourmet tastings at oystergourmet.com. The link's at kcrw.com/goodfood as well. I've always wondered why there aren't serving-sized bottles of wine, like a six-pack for wine drinkers with good wine in them. Bottles of wine serve about 5 healthy glasses. If you eat alone and you don't plan on drinking enough for 3 others, then what do you do with that remaining wine once you've opened a bottle? Stick it in the fridge and you've got less than 2 days to drink it. I'll be back with some ideas on how to keep that wine from ending up going down the drain. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We all have that problem. A little bit of leftover wine. Maybe it's a half a bottle. Maybe it's a quarter of a bottle. What do you do with it? Well, we have some suggestions for what you can do with that leftover wine brought to us from an unusual source, Stacy Hunt from Duvan Wine and Spirits, who usually tells us how to drink the bottle we just opened.
Hi, Evan. I was thinking today about our economic times that we live in. You know, we used to kind of look at a little bit of wine left in a bottle and say, you know, maybe pour it in the sink and put the bottle in the recycle bin. But now I think we have to think of recycling that little dab. First of all, a couple of easy things. If you want to purchase some accessories for your wine, I recommend either the Vacuvin or another product called Preserve. Vacuvin has a little rubberized cork with a plastic pump, and you put the cork in as soon as you're done with the wine, pump it like crazy, and you'll get the air out. And that will preserve the wine. Now, that works for a day or two. Another one is called Private Preserve. This is a spray can, but not the aerosol that hurts the environment. And it's inert gas, and it sprays into the wine bottle, faking out the wine, thinking that it's a full bottle again, and then you just recork it with the wine's own cork. This will also work for about 2 or 3 days, but that's probably about it. Put the wine in the refrigerator. You'll aid in keeping oxidation out because refrigeration does do that, just like it does with your food. And then if you want to blow $60, there's a product called the Keeper. This has a nitrogen coming through a spigot, and you put that in there. But who's got room on their countertop for all that? We don't. So that's just something to think about if you want to, you know, rouse through sharper image. But I think these other two are pretty good. But if you really want to do something creative with wine and know that you're going to be able to have good results from it, I've got a couple of ideas.
Well, we can always make vinegar.
Wine is vinegar. And this is very easy to do. You can go to any winemaking supply store.
Or on the internet. There's so many kits.
Or call a friend.
Right.
Who's making some vinegar. And you get what's called a mother. And if you get this mother, you can plop it into a crock or a glass container and then start pouring your leftover wine in. You can mix it. And some people do this just with champagne, to come up with champagne vinegar. And after a couple of months, you'll have very tasty vinegar. And then after a few more months, you'll have a fairly large mother. And you can start slicing and dicing it off and giving it to your friends. And then everybody will be able to use up their leftover wine that way.
Now, what else can we do?
Well, wine is ice cubes.
Now, what does that mean?
It means you can pour your wine into ice cube trays, leftover wine. And again, you don't have to have a single, you know, little square for each kind of wine. You can blend it, freeze them. After they've frozen, pop them into a baggie, put them back in the freezer. And then every time you're going to make a soup or a stew or a braise.
Oh, what a great idea.
Or anything.
I thought you were going to tell us to use them as ice cubes in like sangria or something.
One problem, because you might have a tannic wine cube, and then you'd stick it into a fruity sangria, and people would say, why does this taste bitter? So I think you're better off throwing it into soups, stews, marinades, anything you can think of. When you're making something, you say, I'd like a little added something. Throw a few cubes in, and that is a perfect way to use wine.
Wow, that's a great idea. I haven't made them in a really long time, but you can also make really great biscotti with wine.
Yeah, wine is cookies. I call them cookies al vino because I'm not sure they're technically biscottis, but they're really fun to make, and this is very easy to do. You just, you know, take any kind of wine and some vegetable oil and some sugar and baking powder and flour and a little bit of salt, and you just make yourself a nice little, you know, doughy ball, and you can either cut it out in shapes, like wine bottle shapes maybe, or wine glass shapes for fun. And then you roll it around in some sugar and bake it for 20 minutes, and you've got cookies al vino.
I love that. What about as a sauce?
Okay, now this one I never thought of. There are a few chefs up in wine country, and you can imagine the kind of leftover wine they've got, who gave me this really good idea. They take shallots and onions and herbs, and they put them in a sauté pan, pour in their excess wine, and they sauté it until it's like a syrup. And you've seen that happen with wine. When it's very thick and syrupy, and also by now the alcohol is really gone, they scrape it all up and they freeze it, and they use it as a very intense flavoring, again, for a sauce, for a soup, or they mix it with some oil and some water and a little touch of lemon, and they create a very special kind of highly intense vinaigrette.
Wow, that sounds delicious.
What else?
How about some drunken cheese bread?
Ooh, that actually sounds really good.
This is a way to use your old baguette. And you know how you have baguette, and if you don't eat that right away.
Oh, really stale fast.
Yeah, you can pound nails in, you know, to your wall with the baguette. Well, here, you take the baguette, slice it. And by the way, if it's all stiff and hard, just sprinkle it with a little bit of water and it'll like reconstitute. Slice it up in rounds and you put a little bit of onion and a little bit of like prosciutto or leftover ham or something like that on it. And then you put it into a buttered baking pan and you douse it with the leftover wine. Just douse away. Let the wine fall off of it and around the pan and everything because that'll get soaked up underneath the bread. And then sprinkle over it any grated cheese that you've got left over. And again, it can be a blend. Stick it in the oven for 20 minutes. Out it comes. And you've got this wonderful, slightly tipsy cheese bread.
Recipes and ideas that Stacy Hunt just mentioned are at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find Stacy at Duvin Wine and Spirits on San Vicente and Melrose. We've all heard of anorexia and bulimia. There's a new phrase that's emerged recently. It's called drunkorexia, and it's the combination of anorexia or bulimia with alcohol abuse. Turns out there's a reason why these two things go together. I'll be right back with an expert in this field that's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We're all familiar with anorexia and bulimia. Well, it seems that for some, alcohol abuse is part of the mix. This is called drunkorexia and seems to be on the rise. Dr. Bunnell is the Director of Outpatient Clinical Services for the Renfrew Center in Philadelphia. It's a residential eating disorder treatment facility. Hi there, Doctor.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Describe what drunkorexia is.
Well, first off, it's important, I think, to note that this is not an official term, and it's really not used in the professional world in terms of trying to understand and treat people with eating disorders. But it describes a phenomenon or a way of eating and calculating intake that at the extreme can be part and parcel of an eating disorder, but at the margins is sort of something that a lot of young women, increasingly young men as well, are getting caught up in. And whereas most people who do this are not going to go on to develop formal eating disorders, it's pretty clear that eating this way or not eating this way and calculating food intake against alcohol intake is quite a dangerous behavior and can set some people on a path towards a formal eating disorder.
So they have this punitive image in their mind in terms of, like, let's say, a basket of what they're allowed to consume in a day. And if they know they're going to go on a binge or have a couple drinks, then they take that out of the basket. And so what's left in terms of food is more minimal.
That's sort of the fundamental premise of it all. I mean, I think you have to sort of step back and look at the overall context of where a lot of these young folks are living and thinking and breathing. And the background, the basic background is that you should not gain weight. In fact, we should all be losing weight, according to most of the media messages. So to try to balance your eating against your alcohol intake is really in the service of preventing weight gain or even furthering weight loss. Now, for some folks, not eating may enhance the drinking. You get drunk faster and get more seriously drunk if you haven't eaten. But I think in terms of what we're talking about today, the driving motivation is about guarding against weight gain.
Wow, it's incredibly sad.
Well, if I could just speak to that, I mean, I have a 21-year-old daughter and sort of have been through adolescence with her. It's absolutely normative for teenage girls and even middle school girls in our country to hate their bodies. And that, to me, has to be a cultural construction. I mean, that's something that our media and our culture has put into these girls' heads. And it's so normal now that we don't even look at it or think about it.
If we know that a lot of the reason this behavior seems to go on has maybe a root of some level of psychological pain, then it would seem almost normal to want to medicate that with alcohol or other substances. Is there a percentage known of how many people with eating disorders tend to medicate themselves?
Many people with eating disorders have what we call comorbid substance abuse problems, so that they're actually caught up in some degree of addiction as well. And if you go to any eating disorder program, residential or higher level of care program, you're probably going to find up to 20% or more of the patients have a comorbid substance abuse problem. So there's a lot of overlap. There's a sort of pain that's looking to be relieved through the behavior.
Do people who are at the more severe end of the continuum, who are serious anorexics or bulimics, sometimes use alcohol to dull the physical pain from starvation?
Not so much the physical pain necessarily, although that's certainly possible. It's more likely they're using substances to help tolerate the starvation or the effects of starvation that may suppress appetite.
How do you treat these kinds of conditions where one element is telling you to abstain and then something else is telling you to consume?
Well, it's a good question. And a lot of the focus of treatment in these disorders is helping patients find a balance in their appetites. And unlike with alcohol or drugs, where you can really work towards an abstinence model and really help people not use at all, that's clearly not a solution for food or for eating. So they have to find some way to tolerate eating enough to be healthy. And on the other end, find a way to tolerate the urge to binge eat enough that they're not gaining weight or setting themselves up to feel like they have to atone for the binge by purging or over-exercising.
What are the psychological and neurological links between eating disorders and substance abuse? Does it give you some sort of high?
there's actually some of the most exciting research in the field and in psychiatry in general right now is on these very issues, on the sorts of neural activity and sort of neural vulnerabilities that patients have that they bring into their lives and then need to find coping strategies for. For instance, with anorexia and the way their brains process reward and pain, and certainly that would make sense too, that they'd be using substances to sort of change that circuitry a little bit.
You know, so much of our current society seems to be about control, finding ways to exert control over your life in the face of so much chaos out there in the world. I mean, I certainly hear this in my interviews with people in terms of just different kinds of diets and different restrictions on eating. Do you see it that way?
Well, I do. I think what I'm more aware of is just that food is everywhere. Food is sort of promoted and marketed to match it up with our emotional needs, and we do that very early on with kids. At the same time, we're flooded with all these messages, and it's actually a setup for people because one of the things, the strongest associations we know in terms of eating disorder sequence is that if people are under-eating, if any of us under-eat for a period of time, our risk of binge eating goes up quite a bit.
Is there a message you'd like to stress for any of our listeners who feel they may be suffering from this disorder, or a parent who might see a child seeming to be flirting with these kinds of behaviors?
There's still the perception out there, unfortunately for most people, that eating disorders are fairly minor, benign illnesses. And the thing I'd really like to stress is that these are serious medical and psychiatric illnesses with the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric diagnosis. If you know someone or you yourself are starting to struggle with these sorts of behaviors, we know you're at increased risk for ending up with an eating disorder. And the earlier we get people into treatment, the more likely that we are to help them avoid a long-term outcome or bad outcome.
Dr. Douglas Bunnell is the Director of Outpatient Clinical Services for the Renfrew Center in Philadelphia, a premier residential eating disorder treatment facility. I'll have a link to the center at our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Hey, let's meet on Facebook. You can become a fan of me, Evan Kleiman, right there. Also, did you know that you can embed this show on your blog or webpage? Go to the kcrw.com/goodfood site and click Listen. You can watch the latest video cast there too and comment on the Good Food blog. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Thanks to Karen Soriano and to Gary Masiha. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.